Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. Super excited today to have Pascal Mules with us from T71 in Dudelange in Luxembourg League. And coach, welcome to the podcast. And you've literally coached in so many places. We don't have time to go through it, but you know, the Netherlands, France, Belgium, you certainly have your FIBA qualifications. Most interesting to people might be that you have a PhD in mathematics, which is an incredible application nowadays to be able to apply a lot of this data that we have coming to us as a basketball coach. So we'll dive into that and so many other topics, but welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, coach. Thank you for having me. I think you have a great platform for coaches and grateful to talk to you.
Well, and you know, I've had a chance to read a number of your blogs and followed you for a while. So let's get into some of the stuff that I think has come out from me observing you and then some of the things that I know you emphasize and talk about. And the first one is, why don't you like pre-programmed drills?
Well, it is something that I like to stress often during my coaching clinics. I still see it so much where also in agility, where players are forced in a pre-programmed setting where they have to sprint to cone number one and then they have to slide to cone number two and so on and so on. And that's pre-programmed. Why I don't like it? Well, because basketball nowadays is not pre-programmed. There is no single way that basketball can be pre-programmed. And I think we have to admit that basketball is one of the most complex sports we have. And it is just impossible to prepare our players to take every single decision on the court, to program them for every decision. That's why we have to make our players smarter and we have to prepare them to make the right decisions on the court. And there is no way where players can be programmed for all the actions on the court.
And that leads into what we want to really sort out for coaches and give them some practical ideas is, how do we make them smarter? Specifically, what do we do within our drills? And I know you've done a clinic on defensive decision making, but let's keep this just in general to start with, and then we'll get into some defensive decision making concepts. But what are some things that we can do to make our players smarter?
Well, for me, it means, for instance, that we have to put our players every single day in situations where they are forced to take decisions. And it also means, or it has a lot to do with the choice of your drills. We cannot have drills where there is one, no decision, and then we come back to the pre-programmed drills. And on top of that, we cannot do every single day the same situations. And maybe one very common example that I like to use is the old-fashioned 11-man drill, where there are two defenders just waiting for us in the paint. For me, that's a bit ridiculous to keep on repeating that drill, because for me, it's not a drill that is game-like. We have to mix it up. If I know coaches that work every single day on that 11-man drill, well, that's ridiculous because it's not game-like. We have to change our drills. We have to look for a lot of variations, and we have to make sure that we use drills which are every single time different, where the defense every single time gives a different look to the players and forces them into a different decision.
Well, and again, like when we talk about that type of drill, the game is way messier than how our organized drills put our players in situations. And you may argue, yes, they're making decisions in those drills, which is true. It's better than doing on air, but it's not representative of how messy and unpredictable the game is. And that's really your point. So maybe, coach, give us an alternative to the 11-man drill, just with a quick explanation.
Well, actually, I like to do a lot of two-on-one and three-on-two drills since we're comparing it to the old-fashioned 11-man drill. Well, actually, I have a drill where the three players in offense, the two not shooters, they have to sprint back. And outside of the court, we have three players waiting. We have a big man waiting behind the baseline who acts like the first trailer in that transition. An extended free throw line, I have two other players, and they will be the new team in offense. And from the team in offense, it are the two not shooters who are sprinting back. What you will see in this drill is that sometimes the defense is early where they have the advantage, but sometimes they will be late and sometimes one of them will be sleeping on the court. So actually it's basically a 3-on-1 drill if you're quick. And these different kinds of things is exactly what the game is, because like you say it, the game is messy. So we have to make sure that also in our drills, it is representative of the game of basketball.
Well, and it's fair to say that the 11-man drill might be a great first drill as you introduce a topic or you introduce some concepts within that. But the fact that you also said is that you can't do it every day. Because again, there's no new stimulus, there's no new learning, because they already know how to game the drill, so to speak. So that's the other part of it. So I think it's important is that it's not even that you shouldn't do the 11-man drill, it's just that you shouldn't spend time there if you do it every day.
Yeah, indeed. And plenty of examples. You can also talk about passing. I've been taught how to play basketball in an era where we were being taught to pass in 2-on-0, just standing in front of each other, where we have to stretch our arms and thumbs are down and stretch the arms. And if we would have a bad game where we had a lot of turnovers, then all week long we would repeat this same thing. And then the next week, if we would have the same amount of turnovers, our coach would go crazy telling us that we were working on passing and whatsoever, which for me is completely ridiculous, because there is no relation between passing in the middle of the court 2-on-0 without a defender in a type of pass which you don't use in a game and having turnovers in a 5-on-5 game. There is just no transfer in between the drill and the game, and that's the problem.
It's a huge problem, and that transfer is the goal. Ultimately, whatever you do in practice, we want it to transfer into the game to help our players and help our team. And there's a simple solution to some of these things, and that 2-on-0 passing drill, for instance, becomes a lot more realistic if you give players freedom of movement and you add one defender. And now if it's 2-on-1 passing and you can move into space and constantly move into relocation spots, then it becomes a little bit more game-like. But going even farther, Coach, is it safe to say that your practices, are they more representative of a game's approach in the sense that you generally play offense versus defense in everything that you do?
Yeah, exactly. What I like to do is to look for a lot of variations. Basketball is so complex that we also have to mix up our drills and mix up the settings, mix up the rules within our drills to have it a slightly different every single practice. And that's just the goal of our practices, because we cannot have coaches on the side that tend to control the 5 players in offense and in defense. If you like that, then you have to buy a PlayStation or an Xbox. And don't get me wrong, I recently discovered playing on a PlayStation, and it can be very fun to do, but it's something completely different than teaching kids or adults how to play basketball. It's two different kind of worlds.
Well, and that may be another discussion someday about the gamification of basketball and how we can bring in some of the PlayStation concepts in terms of how we teach the game to our players to help them relate a little bit more. But really what we're talking about is teaching our players how to relate practice to the game, how to connect those dots and make them the same and not something different. Because really, when you move that 2-on-0 passing into a game situation, players that have to essentially relearn everything that we taught them within the context of the game. And that's why, again, it's something that's very challenging. Coach, how about defense? Like, it's often misunderstood that we can train defensive decision-making just as much as offensive decision-making. What are some of the things that you do to help your players train defensive decision-making?
Well, like you say, it can be taught too, just as offense. And it also means that I use the same concepts in the sense that also in defense, I try to force my players in different kinds of drills, situations, which are representative of the game of basketball. And sometimes it can also happen that we use exactly the same drills than in offense, but just running the drills, you run them differently. Like the drill we discussed, the 3-on-2 transition drill, well, actually, it is also my first drill in teaching how to do a defensive transition. Because when I have the 2 players running back in defense, well, I have certain rules for those two defenders. My very first defender sprinting back in defense, well, he's going to a spot and he's yelling out safety. And the second one is going to the top of the key and he yells stop. And I use that very same drill to teach my very first step in defensive transition. And once that step has been taken, well, we add a third defender and we have a third rule for that defender too. And also there, that's the way how we build up our defense. Again, it's the same way we put them into situations where every single time the situation is slightly different and we try to implement our defensive rules, our defensive game plan into the real life game of basketball.
Well, the concept, and I want coaches to catch this,
you say is slightly different, is that we're looking for that constant optimal challenge to be able to load our players, to challenge our players to improve. And that's such a great terminology to be able to use. You briefly talked about it, but what are some of the loads that you can add or the slight differences you can add, say, to an example like that drill from a day-to-day basis to change it slightly to make it, again, so that your players have to fight for their learning, they have to be outside their comfort zone, and really, they have to heighten mental effort. So they're constantly making decisions.
Well, yeah, and there are really slightly differences. It can be where the outlet pass has been given. For instance, a team in offense, maybe they cannot just start free throw line extended, but they have to start behind the baseline. Maybe the only difference could be that after a basket, the team in offense, that they have to take the ball out of bounds, yes or no. Because that is basically, it gives you either half a second more or less in your defensive transition. Or also the way how we count the game. Are we counting defensive stops or are we just counting baskets? And within one drill, I would say you can use it in 10 different ways how to run it and depending on your goal as a coach. And maybe if somebody would walk into my practices, maybe they would say, yeah, but you're doing two, or you two are also running every single day a drill again and again. Yeah, but that can be true, but with a different purpose and with different rules. And that's how I work on something different in still a game like basketball drill.
Again, it's sometimes the constraints we put into the drill. Sometimes it's a scoring system we use in the drill. Sometimes it's location and starting points or ending points. It's all these different things that can influence a drill and change it slightly. And I think it's a really important concept is like really what we're talking about is not complicated. Like essentially, if I went to your practices from a day-to-day basis, I might not notice unless I'm really, really paying attention that you're doing different things within the drill. But one, it's a simplicity for your players because they know the drill. But two, they know every day that you're picking certain things to emphasize and develop. And then I am assuming from there, your assessment from day-to-day in practice dictates what you do the next day in terms of emphasis within the drill.
Exactly. And actually, nowadays, yeah, coaches, they have access to so many websites and blogs and YouTube channels full of basketball drills. But for me, those are not secrets. Being a basketball coach, it is not just having a book or a channel where you can pick up drills and where you can write them down to prepare your practices. And I have two lines and defender A has to go next to that line and whatsoever. It is not the drill that makes the difference. It is what you as a coach, what you do with the drill, how you use it on a daily basis, and what you ask from your players. It's the same thing with a playbook in offense. The magic play, it doesn't exist. It all comes down to finding the right play for your team, how to teach it, and how to take advantage of it during a game. And it's the same thing with a basketball drill.
It's so true. I mean, coaches that
want to come watch my practices, I almost want to give them a disclaimer and say, really, I mean, relative to going to a practice and picking up a ton of drills or a ton of things like that, my practices are kind of boring. Like really, essentially, it's 4-on-4, 5-on-5, the whole practice. And they're nothing special. It's just you put them in a situation that we're going to work on in offense versus defense, and we coach them at the same time. And I'm assuming you get into that where you do a lot of cross-teaching, offense and defense at the same time. Has that helped your development as a coach overall, that you're able to coach both sides of the ball at the same time?
Yes, exactly. Without a doubt. It is something where you have to grow in. because judging a game and an offense and in defense, and sometimes you have to be the ref too, well, that's quite a challenge. And I remember well that when I started out as a coach, I wasn't that good in it as I am today. And I'm still a student of the game and I'm still trying to improve. But there are so many things you have to pay attention on the basketball court. For me, that's one of the big challenges as a coach. And basically, you learn by just doing it. And it's just the experience that counts. And of course, it helps if you have a good assistant and where he knows what his role is. And there you can get some help too, of course.
That's great. And coach, is there any room
for on-air skill development in your practices? So we're teaching a player a move. We're teaching a player, let's stay away from shooting, because I think we both agree there's some isolated shooting work that can help. But is there any room for on-air skill development within your practices?
In team practices, of course, that's quite limited. If you have practices in small groups, I would say yes, but very soon you will add it in a one-on-one drill, and you will add it in a situation where you add defense, maybe a few less defenders or more players in offense, or you can mix it up, but very, very soon you go into a live setting where you add the decision-making, because whatever you move you make, and like you say, shooting might be the only exception, all the other things, you want to do it right away in a setting where it is kind of live and where you add decision-making and where you add some kind of defense.
And I've seen some of your clinic stuff,
so I have an advantage here, but it seems to me like you value one-on-one. In terms of skill development, that would be probably your number one thing, is that you do a lot of one-on-one?
Yeah, absolutely. With sometimes the defender where they are limited or where there is some kind of decision-making. And actually, maybe the reason why I stress that so much is because I remember very well when I was a kid, that's the thing that has been overlooked. To give a very simple example, when we would do 1-on-0 teaching the crossover step, technically, I would be great. Teaching the open step right afterwards, technically, I would be one of the best of my team. But then the next step, that would be just to play live 1-on-1 with no restrictions at all. And I think there, we skipped a step. And that step is exactly decision-making. We need some kind of intermediate step where we program the defense, which makes that the offense has to take a decision between that crossover step and that open step. And there our brains need to be taught into taking a decision, which one of my two moves, do I have to use in which situations? And that's, for me, decision-making. And that's a step that cannot be skipped.
What you're saying is decision-making
with only two variables, two possibilities, rather than going completely open right away. And that's a part that I think coaches sometimes misunderstood about when we talk about a games approach or we talk about letting the players figure it out, is that we will use a constraints-led approach to be able to say, hey, listen, here are your two possibilities. You figure out which one is best. And rather than just throw them in the deep end and say, go for it, figure out anything, right? And that's what you're talking about in terms of that. Now, you're talking about limiting the defender. Can you talk about some specific examples of that, how you limit the defender to influence offensive or defensive decision-making?
Well, there are different possibilities, of course. I have in my mind a couple of drills which I like to use where there is a defender where actually you could say that the defender first, he has to touch a cone on one or both sides, and that gives one split second to the offense to take a decision to take his, let's say now, to give the example, to keep it simple, that crossover step or that open step, to beat him to the left or to the right. I know other drills where, for instance, the defense first has to give a low five to the coach on one of each sides, which again gives that split second to the offense to make that decision in between left and right. But it can also be more open. Limiting the defense, for instance, well, it could also be that, for instance, the defense is holding a ball with his both hands in front of him in playing defense, which actually, yeah, sometimes you can also look at it as a drill for the footwork of the defense. And of course, it gives an advantage to the offense because defense will be slower when he's holding the ball in his two hands.
I've seen some of this stuff.
And the other thing that you talk about, which I couldn't agree with more, and maybe you can give your explanation, but this traditional one-on-one of being shoulder to shoulder and checking the ball, you know, and letting the offense and the defense play with no starting point, like no advantage. Can you talk about why that's very limiting in terms of development?
Well, yeah, it isn't one-on-one like that. It is also in three-on-three like that. I really dislike a stationary start of a drill, where, for instance, also in three-on-three, you have a guard and two wings and defense are waiting. The coach hands over the ball and says, let's go now. For me, it doesn't work. For me, it kills every intensity of the drill. And on top of that, it's not game-like. And I really want to have a dynamic start. And that start can be different. It can be that one of the guys is sprinting out of the corner, gets the pass of the coach, and that we start off the catch. But there we have a dynamic start. And actually, it is like you enter a game on a certain moment of a real game on the catch. And also the two other players, they are moving. The only thing is, as a coach, you have to make sure that your dynamic start, well, that it differs, that it is also game-like and that you handle all kinds of different situations. But for me, it's always worked great when I have a dynamic start of the drill.
Well, again, for coaches to understand,
I mean, essentially, with maybe one random exception or one outlier exception, very few players can attack and score in a game from a stationary start. So that situation just never happens in a game. Now, if I go back to how we actually score, I mean, a high percentage comes from one-on-one opportunities, but those opportunities come from the offense already having an advantage. They came off a screen, they came off a ball screen, they came off a cut, and they have some type of slight advantage, and then they know how to finish that advantage. And that's really what we're talking about here, is creating those game situations, correct?
Exactly. I couldn't say it any better. It is as if you're coming out of that advantage. Because like you say, if you start it stationary, very often, yeah, it also kills the flow of your offense. It is something that I really don't want to have as a coach. I don't want to have the ball in one of my players' hands and where he starts shaking his shoulders for 3-4 seconds before he even thinks about attacking the basketball. And we want him coming off a screen, coming out of the corner, filling a spot or whatever. Those are the kinds of situations I'm looking for also in my practices.
Well, and come back to your theme of
slightly different, is that the other part of one-on-one is, look, if you're playing truly one-on-one, then I feel like every player should get to the basket. Like there should be really no mid-range and there should be no threes. If you're a good one-on-one player, you should get advantage at the rim. So to counter that, because that's not the reality of the game, that we need to progress one-on-one to some type of 2-on-2, 3-on-2, some type of advantage, disadvantage, so that now that player has some decision-making off the ball as well. Is that the next step that you go through with your one-on-one progressions?
Yes, of course. I like to think about the fact that I have that same one-on-one situation we talked about before, where the player in offense has a slight advantage. But now on the other side, we have another player in offense and, of course, a player in help side and defense. And that makes that either that player in offense, the advantage is that big that he still can finish at the basket, or there he got interfered by the player in help defense. And there we come into our two-on-two concept. And once we have that two-on-two concept, of course, the next step is three-on-three, four-on-four, and finally five-on-five, of course.
And you said that within your team practices then.
I assume, like a lot of European pro teams, they practice twice a day. Are you guys a twice-a-day program there?
Well, yes and no. I coach in a league in Luxembourg where we have some of our players, they have a job on the side. So that means that team practices, we have them with everybody 5 times a week. But my practices in the morning, there I only have 5 or 6 players, which is actually great because in the morning I can work with those players in smaller groups, more individual, and I have one complete team practice in the evening where I have 12, 13 players.
But it sounds like what most
AU high school youth coaches have to deal with. It's just, there's not always the perfect scenario for practice. So, and again, a lot of these small-sided games or this type of decision-making can be developed outside of five-on-five.
Exactly. And that's what I try to do on a daily basis.
Can you talk a little bit? Because you've talked about not wanting to start from stationary, which I totally agree with. Can you talk a little bit about starting five-on-five? Do you start five-on-five from stationary sometimes? Or what are some things that you do to start five-on-five possession? Say you're playing three trips or you're playing multiple trips to the floor or even one trip. What are some things that you do to start five-on-five?
Well, that really depends. In five-on-five, sometimes I build it up from a five-on-zero, and then we go more live with the defense, of course, in terms of having that dynamic start or the different kind of games. Well, it depends. What I recently like to do often on practice is play to a number of stops in defense where we are really running up and down the court a couple of times where we just play. I call it a sudden death, like in European soccer, where we play to a number of defensive stops.
Well, that's cool. That's great. Good terminology as well. But that's, I think, another place where some coaches get stuck sometimes on their creativity in starting five on five. And you don't have to start it from a check ball possession. Obviously, you can start it. I know I've got a lot of controversy sometimes from starting possessions from a turnover, where it's an intentional turnover, and then you have to figure out how to transition and flow and stuff. But those are realistic situations that happen in the game. And as you've alluded to already, as much of that is about defensive decision-making. So you give the offense the advantage in one-on-one, but you're also trying to teach your defense how to recover in one-on-one from giving up an advantage, which is inevitable. What are some of the cues that you give to your defenders in those situations?
In having a disadvantage compared to the offense, you mean?
Yeah, and recovering from, really, I mean, your one-on-one drills, you're teaching your defender how to recover from a disadvantage because you're starting the offense with an advantage, correct?
Yes, indeed. And then, well, of course, in your defense, what's very important, that's, of course, the intensity and the communications. And also there, in my defensive drills, well, actually, the defense has to make up for that disadvantage. And it's difficult to talk about it like this because we don't have a concrete drill in our head. But it also depends on the drill, of course.
Of course. Yeah, no, of course. And talking about defense, one of the other things that I love that I heard you say was that players don't talk because we don't tell them what to say.
Yes, exactly. It amazes me how many coaches are during games, they're going crazy next to the sideline and they're yelling at their players that they should talk on the court. But sometimes on the court, then I see kids looking at each other with big eyes, like saying, yeah, what the hell should I say, coach? I mean, and that's, for me, that's a big problem. We, as a team, we have to make a defensive philosophy. And we, as a team, I think every coach has a playbook for his offense during a season. But I think it's even more important to have a defensive playbook. And what's a defensive playbook? Well, for instance, that is, what should I say on which moment? And can go very wide, and you have different examples. I mentioned already one or two in the beginning of the podcast. When my players are running back in defense, the defensive transitions, there we have certain rules. The first player back, he's running with his head on the basket and he's yelling out, safety, safety. The second one is stop. The third one is yelling ball. And there we have that many verbals we have to use. The same thing on a trap, on a double teaming on the low post, when we're hedging the ball screens, when should we recover? Well, teach your players which words to yell at which exact moment. That is so important. You cannot just start a season and start coaching your very first game with a team and just yell at your players. You have to talk in defense. Talking, what is it? Using which word in which situation?
Dave Smart is one of the best coaches in the world, and now you can learn from him with never before available access. Three all-access practices and one defensive coaching clinic are available at davesmartbasketball.com. What makes these all-access practice and clinic videos so unique? Dave Smart has won 12 national championships and has a winning percentage of 92%. Dave Smart's Force Weak Hand defensive system is world-renowned and has never been shared in this way before. Dave Smart has a winning record in over 50 games versus NCAA Division I teams, having beaten Wichita State, Baylor, Wisconsin, and many others. Dave Smart is recognized by Jay Wright, Mick Cronin, Jay Triano, and many other top coaches in the world as one of the best minds in basketball. Learn from one of the greatest minds in the game who opened his doors and shared the game with us from one of the most successful basketball programs in the world. Go to davesmartbasketball.com now to learn more and to purchase all four videos.
Well, again, that's such an important part for coaches to understand and to really work towards. I mean, so many offensive plays to get on YouTube, so many offensive plays to get Fast Model, et cetera, so many great resources, but your defensive terminology and teaching it to your players. And as you said, not just what, but when you raise that example, what do your players say in recovery on ball screen? What's the terminology that you guys use?
Well, for me, that is back. The moment when I talk, for instance, let's say we hard hedge our screens on the ball side, when the player on the ball thinks he has it, well, he just yells out back. And that's for me the sign that the big man, that he can recover back with his hands up in the passing lane, back to his original defender. And we have different kinds of rules. For instance, if we play a flat hedge for the middle ball screens, well, we also have a rule that a paint touch, that it automatically becomes a switch. What does it mean? That means that the player with the ball, if he attacks the flat hedge and when he has 1 foot in the bucket, well, there we yell out switch, and it automatically means that we switch that ball screen. But you have to make rules. You have to set rules. From where on is it a ball screen? Or is it a switch into that ball screens? Otherwise, you will always have discussion and there will be a gray zone. And yes, coach, but I thought that he, this and that. And that makes it very complicated. You have to set rules. Either that foot, he touched the bucket, either he didn't. And that's for me the rule. And that's the difference between making either the switch or no switch. And like that, it is more clear and it helps your players.
Coach, we would obviously, this wouldn't be as beneficial if we did not dive a little bit into some of the analytics, since you are the first PhD in mathematics I've ever talked to who coaches basketball, which is a great, great thing. So let's get into some of, we don't have to talk as much about how data has transformed the game, because we certainly understand that it has. But what are some of the personal stats that you value as a coach with this knowledge that you have, and maybe some of them that are the most useful for coaches to be able to apply?
Well, there are different things to say. First of all, because people know that I have a background in mathematics, maybe they think that on practice or in preparing games that I'm doing only stats. And sometimes I get to remark, yeah, but numbers, they are just numbers and you don't win a game with numbers. Yeah, I know. And I completely agree. But why do I use those analytics and those stats? Well, actually, if they give me one single number in preparing a game that makes a difference, then for me, it is a success. And then I know that every minute spent on taking those stats is a success. So basically, I would say that if it gives me one key going into the game, then for me, it was worth it. And in keeping the analytics, well, actually, it really depends. It also depends on your personnel. But some of the things I like to keep track of is also on the bench. For instance, the number of deflections. If we are playing a game And for instance, as a coach, you're not really satisfied about your defensive intensity and you talk about it at halftime. Well, maybe some of your players in the locker room, they're thinking, ah, coach, maybe it wasn't that bad, was it? And there is nothing concrete to talk about. And for instance, also there, it's the same thing as with that paint touch. You have to make it concrete. If you have an injured player on the bench who is tracking down the number of deflections during that half time, that first half, well, you have something to talk about at halftime. Either as a team, you combined for enough deflections, either you didn't. And there also there, you take away the gray zone. And that's, for me, that's very useful. And another thing is, not everything you can do during the game. Also, it is also the stats you make up after the game based upon the video. And I remember it was one of my past seasons where we really, as a team, we had a problem in sharing the ball. So what I did there was, for a couple of games, I tracked down the scores we had on a game and the number of passes that led to that score. And actually, I made it very simple, also understandable for the players. And actually, the conclusion of the whole thing was that the more passes we gave in an offense, the more chance we had to end up with a bucket. Even when with a few passes, you have the fast break situations and whatsoever, it appeared that we had a team where the more passes we gave, the more chances of success we had during that possession. And actually, it is up to you as a coach to explain it, to show it in such a way that it is clear to everybody. And back then, that was a very hard season. We were struggling and whatsoever. But that video session, that was the most successful of the whole season, because there I had all my players on the same page and convinced of having one single goal, and that is to have a better offensive flow. And for the next weeks, the only thing I had to do as a coach was to remind them of that video session. There was no discussions, and we were all on the same page to go and look for that offensive flow.
Well, it's great, because essentially what you're saying in that example and then overall is the use of stats and analytics removes generalities, which coaches tend to speak far too often in generalities. We're not playing hard. We're not rebounding. We've got to pass the ball more, blah, blah, blah. We can go on and on with all the general things that coaches say. And the use of analytics relative to your team helps remove that. And in that example, you talked about passing more. That passing more for that team led to more success.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what I mean. And what is it? Defending harder, going harder for a rebound. If I put myself on the bench being a player, well, I can imagine that sometimes I would be thinking, yeah, coach, but what do you mean? I'm sweating all the way. I think I did it hard. I think I did the best I could, but it's not. And to make it, yeah, to be able to quantify it, those numbers help. And those numbers help too to the players to understand what you're talking about. Very recently, I had a discussion, well, not a discussion with my team, but actually it was after the game. And also there were some doubts. Yeah, did we play hard enough last weekend? Yes or no? Well, actually, I went back to our games and I was counting all the 50-50 balls. 50-50 balls being balls bouncing on the court where none of the two teams had control over it. Well, I tracked them down. And for us, that game, it wasn't the 50-50 ball. It was more often for the other team. And then it is, for me, fair to say that the other team, they wanted it more than we did. So they deserved to win that game. And it also, for me and for the whole team, it closed the decision. We didn't play hard enough. If you play hard enough, those 50-50 balls, that's where you gain the advantage.
So that's great. What are some other ways that we can measure playing hard or measure effort? What are some simple ways that coaches can measure those things to be able to, again, remove that generality about us saying, hey, we're not playing hard?
Well, one of the things is, of course, I mentioned already the deflections. How many times as a team can you have a hand on the ball in defense without resulting it on the stats as a complete steal. Because for me, every single time you can deflect a pass where the player has to catch the ball 2 meters further out of his regular spot in the set play of the other team, well, for me as a team, that's a success. And it isn't written down as a steal on the stat sheet. So for me, a deflection, that's very important. The number of 50-50 balls, of course. And very important is also the number of defensive rebounds. And also there, you have to be careful. That's also for the defensive rebounds. That's also where I try to grab towards the more advanced stats instead of just the number of rebounds. Because I can imagine a completely lopped game between two teams where one team is barely missing any shots and the other team is missing tons of shots. Well, then it's more than common sense that also the chances to take a defensive rebound is very lopsided in between the two teams.
What are some misconceptions then about stats that maybe we're not understanding? What are some misconceptions that coaches have about stats?
Well, I think the easiest way to explain it is that in regular stats, we don't take into account the concept of pace. Pace, for me, is defined as the number of possessions you have during a game. And you have fast-paced teams, teams that really, on average, they push the ball and they take quick shots and they have more possessions a game than another team. And of course, that concept of pace, well, it determines a lot about stats. Because a team that is having more possessions a game, well, wouldn't it be more than logic that it also has more turnovers a game, more steals a game, more assists a game, more points scored during a game, but also more points allowed during a game? A team that has more possessions a game than any other team, well, it has everything more. And in one of the articles I wrote about it on those advanced stats in the Belgian league, well, I think it was a beautiful example. It was an example of one first division team where one coach was fired after playing every single team one single time. And actually, the general reason behind that was, well, our offense was very good because we scored more points than the average in the league. The defense wasn't well enough because we allow also more points a game. Well, I'm sorry, but the reason it was complete bullshit because it was just the fastest playing team in the league. And the team that plays the fastest in the league, well, logically, they score more points than the opponent or than the average of the league. But they also allow more points. And when back then I went to the advanced stats and you look to offensive rating and defensive rating instead of points scored and points allowed, well, actually, it appeared that that team, that it was even doing better in defense than it was in offense. And then I'm not talking about whether it was right or wrong to fire the coach or whether he did a great job or not, because I don't know it. I wasn't there. I wasn't there during the practices and I wasn't there during the games. The only thing I'm saying is that if the reason was that he was fired because the defense was bad, that's completely wrong.
So, and again, that's interesting because that's what we hope, you know, certainly at that level that the ownership or the decision makers have that information and understand that now. But it's truly still something that pace is divisive if you don't understand its impact on overall numbers, especially a general box score, if you're looking at that. So, coach, dive into a little bit. And I know that this is one example, so we're not arguing on behalf of playing slower or faster, but you did an analysis of how to win more games by playing slower. First off, did that change your thinking about your style of play currently? And what were some of the conclusions that may help coaches in terms of that? Because generally all this stuff is saying to people that they should be playing faster. That seems to be the message that comes across from analytics. And I know there's a bunch of coaches that still believe in playing slower. So can we talk about that a little bit?
Yes, of course. Well, actually, the analysis you're talking about, it's the analysis of last season of the Belgian League. And there I was looking for a correlation in between the pace of basketball and the offensive rating instead of or in terms of being most efficient in offense. And actually, I came to a conclusion I didn't expect. And the conclusion was that the four slowest playing teams in Belgium, well, exactly those were the four most efficient teams in offense. It was very surprising for me because when I looked to the NBA, I saw at that point exactly the opposite, having the fastest playing teams also be the more efficient. And I think in a certain way, it was also an outlier. But when today, when I look to different leagues, well, maybe it isn't an exception either. Because for instance, if you look to the EuroLeague, there was the first team in the ranking, that's Fenerbahce from Turkey. Well, without a, or with a distance, they're the slowest paced team of the EuroLeague. And guess what? They have the highest offensive rating. And I can give more examples too. At this point in the Netherlands, the slowest playing team is the second most efficient in offense. And maybe even we have to go back to the NBA nowadays, this very season. At this point, Houston, they have the second best offensive rating and still they're having the third lowest pace. And who's playing the fastest in the NBA right now, today, this season? Well, it is Atlanta. And I don't think that Atlanta is being the most efficient in offense. So I do think there is a correlation in between pace and efficiency in offense. And I also think that playing fast, sometimes it is just the lack of creating good shots out of a set offense. And if I look to the leagues in the countries where I have been coaching or close to where I live, well, actually, then I see that a lot of the less talented teams, well, they tend to play rushed. And there is a difference in between playing rushed and between playing fast. Rush, for me, that's also a team that struggles to create a good shot late in the shot clock, that can really use their set plays in creating a good shot. Those are also the teams that will take a rush shot very early in the offense because maybe they realize that it's the best shot they will have during that whole possession. And that's one of the reasons why I think that in some of those leagues, you see that teams playing very, very fast, that they're not always being the most efficient in offense. And yes, it makes me think, because we had a couple of years where Golden State was breaking every record and we're playing faster and faster and faster. And without even knowing it, we all tend to copy it. Also because all the players and all the youngsters, they watch the NBA and they take them as examples. But maybe we come back to the beginning of our podcast. Maybe as a coach, we have to think what is best for our team. And it doesn't mean that playing faster and faster, that it is the best way for Golden State to do it. We have to see what is the most efficient for our team.
How do we determine that, though, Coach? I mean, is that just purely view my philosophy? Or is that personnel driven? Like, sometimes within a season, like as a coach, and I'm sure you've been in this situation, like your style of play or your emphasis or different things like that, you begin to question sometimes if it's not leading to success or it's not leading to wins. Because, again, the bottom line, the most important stat is wins and losses. So how can I actually make that decision in advance, if that's even possible, or if I can't within the season, how can I make an adjustment based on understanding whether we should be playing faster or slower?
Well, it's a bit of everything. It depends on your personnel. It depends on you as a coach. Is it always to predict it in advance? And you, can you say in advance what is working best for your team? Yes or no? No, I don't think so. I even think, or I believe, that within a season, well, you have different kinds of periods where you tend to play differently. There are moments in the seasons where you rely more on your offensive playbook and you rely more on your set plays to create your shot selection and offense. And there are more situations where everybody is full of confidence and your shooters are really hot, and you also in transition, you're full of confidence to take those early shots in transition. But when you're struggling with your confidence in your team, that's also the moment where you should rely more on your set offenses to create those good shots. So I really think that even within a season, you have to mix it up. And it also depends on the actual state of mind of your team at that very moment.
Well, it's a great, great point. And something obviously to think about is, as you try and decide on the style of play, and then obviously within whether it's working or not. And that's the beautiful thing about this. Maybe just as we wrap this up, Coach, what are some other things in terms of the analytics that you think coaches are missing out on that we should pay more attention to?
Well, it's difficult to say just in general. I like to have a broad view of the analytics, of the stats. Throughout the season, I keep my own stats, and once in a while, I just take the time basically to sit in my chair and to really reflect upon things. And the reason why I write those articles about the Belgian League and the Euro League and other kinds of leagues is I like to have a broad view over basketball, and I like to see how they're doing it differently in other countries and how I can relate that into my team. And for me, coaching a team during a season, well, for me, it's also keeping those eyes open. And sometimes halfway of the season, well, you pick up an ID which you have seen in an analysis in the NBA or in EuroLeague, and you pick it up and you can use it to construct a video session. And what I told you earlier about those 50-50 balls, maybe that's one kind of an example. I read a tweet about the 50-50 balls, and I thought that's exactly what we need as a team. And then you combine it. You make the stats out of a game. You add the video of those 50-50 balls, and I think then you can have a great video session with your team, which really solves the problem that you're having with your team in that specific moment. And that's, for me, coaching. That's how you can help your team. But for me, a very important condition is that you have to have a wide view over coaching and over different leagues. And you have to pick up things everywhere. And that's also why I consider myself as an eternal student of the game.
Well, your background
and the learning experiences you have obviously paint that picture as well. I think the important thing you said there too, Coach, which you've said another time within this podcast, is that you marry the analytics with video. So you bring those two concepts together so that your players not only get the analytics, but they get the visual that goes with it and saying, hey, we're doing this or we're not doing this, and here's the specific example. Is that something that is a must for coaches to do?
Absolutely. Because let's be honest, it's not because I'm a mathematics geek or nerd that my players are. We know that a large percentage of them, they really hate mathematics and they hate numbers. So I really cannot convince my players by the numbers only. I think I would lose them after really 3 minutes into my video session. It is making things as simple and as clear as possible, and combine it with some video, with some footage of your own game. And also recently, I like to watch more and more video about our own games instead of games of the opponent, because it really makes us better as a team. And also there, I think during a season as a coach, you can have flaws where you have periods where you look more to the strategy of the other team, and other periods and weeks and months where you focus more on your own team.
Well, it's a constant challenge for a coach,
especially one that doesn't have necessarily full-time staff or have any staff at all beyond volunteers, is you have to make decisions constantly about what you're going to spend time on to the benefit of your team and your players. And I love that you said that, because I agree with that, is that spending time on self-scout usually pays more dividends than opponent scout. But traditional and cultural norms in coaching paint such an emphasis and such a glory to scouting your opponent. What are some things that you do to self-scout your team then?
It really depends from game to game. You have to keep in mind a couple of basics in the sense that, well, you cannot show only negative things. On the other side, I don't think as a coach it is your job to show highlights or only highlights of your own team. It is not as a coach that you're the cheerleader of your own team. In these words, you really have to mix it up. And I always work with a couple of teams. So you cannot have more than 2-3 teams into a video session. And to be very honest, my video sessions, well, they never last longer than half an hour. Because after half an hour, the focus is gone. And you have to make your clips and your video session better and more efficient to transfer your message within half an hour. And I really think that is possible to do.
It's great advice. And just again, so much through this whole podcast that can help direct coaches and stimulate their thinking about not only applying decision-making within practice, but also the use of analytics. And those are two topics that are close to both of our hearts. I know that. So coach, I really appreciate you taking some time, and we'll share a bunch of your stuff when we post the podcast as well, so coaches can follow you and read some of those blogs. But any closing thoughts in terms of advice to coaches?
Well, yes, maybe I do want to add one more thing about the video. You asked me about it, and actually one of the other things I like to do, of course, like many coaches, I also have a WhatsApp group with my players. And sometimes it is not always a complete video session. If I have one clip of 30 seconds or 1 minute for one ID, one team I want to handle during the evening practice, well, around 10 o'clock in the morning, I just post the video in the group without any comment. And everybody will have seen the video by the time they step into the gym in the evening, and everybody will know what we are working on.
Well, it's such a simple way nowadays
to be able to get information to your players, and that's awesome. And a number of coaches have mentioned that, and we use a private Facebook group in the same way. And, you know, the other part is, I'm curious, do you use that group to get them to be able to interact with what you post as well? Is there opportunity for them to add their information or their feedback to that?
Yes, they can. But it really depends on the topic, whether they do it, yes or no. And sometimes it can be something very positive and very fun, and everybody is reacting on it, and everybody is very enthusiastic about it. But sometimes it's also bad news to announce, or sometimes it is just something which we didn't good enough during the game. And I post a video anyway, and then I know that nobody is going to react, and everybody is a bit, how would I say, even a bit annoyed in arriving in the evening practice, because everybody is a bit annoyed by what he saw in that video. But maybe sometimes that is exactly what I need to start a practice, to have a little bit of nastiness and a little bit of a cranked ego to start practice. Sometimes, not always.
Well, it relates,
and I think it parallels teaching what you talked about at the beginning is, it always has to be something slightly different. And I think video's got to be the same, exactly what you're saying. They're not all highlights. They're not all positives. They're not all negatives. There's this mix and this constant effort to be able to stimulate and load your players so that they interact with the material that you provide them, you know, whether it's in the moment or, as you said, later in practice. So that's a great example of how you can use those type of groups effectively. Thanks for sharing that, coach. And again, thanks so much for joining us and for sharing so much information. I so encourage coaches to follow you on social media because you're a wonderful sharer of information as well.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it, and we'll talk soon.
A quick interruption to this week's episode to let you know what you're missing if you are not currently a member of basketballimmersion.com. Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA, NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to basketballimmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.